You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme.
Ich hoffe,
I hope and we will make clear that we want those people who think differently in Russia to have a chance to articulate their thoughts, though I know it is anything but easy.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel there on the murder of Russian opposition leader Boris Nemtsov. Vladimir Putin has called the killing a disgrace. We'll be asking whether he really wants to get to the bottom of it. Ms. Merkel has been in Brussels meeting EU Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker. Ukraine was on the agenda, so too was Greece. We'll analyse those discussions. And finally, here in the UK, the Royal Mint has updated the portrait of Queen Elizabeth II. Does she now look her age, and does it matter? My guests today are the ever young Mary Dajewski and Quentin Peel. They'll be giving us their views on those stories and more. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Before we talk to Mary Dajewski and Quentin Peel, let's take a look at some of the day's top headlines so far. As we just heard, Russian President Vladimir Putin has demanded an end to shameful political killings after the murder last week of opposition politician Boris Nemtsov. In the United States, a key provision of the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare, will be discussed at the Supreme Court. We'll be looking at that story in more detail on tonight's Monocle Daily. Insurgents have attacked a Syrian government security building in Aleppo today. Dozens of people have been killed on both sides, according to a monitoring group. And Vienna has been named the city with the highest quality of life by Mercer. Three German cities make the top 10, with Dusseldorf, surprisingly, the highest ranked. Of course, Monocle's own quality of life survey, a far superior beast, if you don't mind me saying, is out this summer. A couple of front pages in Los Angeles, they have a good story on Ferguson police violated blacks' rights, US says. This is a report from the Justice Department into the events in Ferguson, but also looking at what happened over the past 20 or 30 years. And the Boston Globe, jury in place, opening statements today in marathon bombing trial. Now, my guests today are Mary Dajewski, chief editorial writer and columnist with The Independent, and Quentin Peel, senior fellow at Chatham House. Mary and Quentin, welcome both to the programme. Let's begin with the murdered Russian opposition leader Boris Nemtsov. As we heard, President Putin has commented on the killing for the first time, calling it a disgrace. Nemtsov, a former deputy prime minister, was killed on Friday evening near Red Square. The Kremlin has denied any involvement in the murder, saying that the killing was a provocation designed to discredit Putin and strengthen his opponents. Now, Quentin and Mary, you both obviously know Russia very well. Mary Dajewski, there have been killings of prominent Russians before, politicians, journalists, that the Kremlin haven't liked. How does this killing rank in terms of how shocked we are at seeing what's happened?
It's one of the absolute most serious. It's most serious for the opposition and it's most serious for the Kremlin, because there is nothing good that could come out of the killing of Boris Nemtsov. You can say that his star was in the descendant as an opposition leader, which is true. He was part of the first wave of opposition, the anti-Soviet opposition in the late 80s. He was one of that generation, even though he actually, you know, he's only 55 when he died. Nonetheless, the fallout from this killing, because he was so prominent, because it takes place in these circumstances where Russia and Ukraine are in such tension verging on war, and because Putin is in the position he is, I think it's one of the absolute most serious crises he's faced.
Quentin Peel, it's very easy for people in the West to say, well, Putin's been talking about the fifth column, who are amongst us. There have been, you know, Nemtsov has been mentioned as one of these so-called traitors, perhaps funded by the West, who aren't true Russian nationalists. And yet also, it's hard to see what President Putin gains from this killing.
Yes, I think that's probably fair, although I think that Boris Nemtsov was a potential threat to Vladimir Putin because he was quite so sharp and outspoken. The last time I saw him, he just produced a lot of evidence about corruption surrounding the Kremlin and surrounding Putin himself. And this was stuff that I felt it was unpublishable. It was actually sailing much too close to the wind. And I think he was, nonetheless, he really pushed it. And I think he was about to produce evidence on Ukraine and Russia's intervention in Ukraine, which could have been very embarrassing. So it's possible, if Putin did not himself order the killing, that somebody who thought that they would please Mr. Putin by bumping him off may have carried it out.
Mary Dzhevsky, is there, in fact, as I believe someone on this show yesterday said, something of the who will rid me of this turbulent priest?
Well, I think in some ways it's too simple to look at it like that. But obviously that, you know, that was almost the first, your first response to what happened. But as I say, I think it actually makes more difficulties for Putin than it solves. And of course, when you hear him today saying, you know, we've got to get to the bottom of this and, you know, this must be the last political killing. Well, yes, that's true. But, you know, who's in charge in this country? That is the question that's posed.
And all the political killings, one must say, have been of opposition people. I mean, it's not as if there have been political killings going in the other direction. So it really makes one very cynical. I don't know if you've seen the front cover of the magazine Private Eye here in London today with Putin with a big wink saying, I'm really going to get to the bottom of this.
Well indeed. And, you know, that's the thing, Quint, is it, that he said he's going to get to the bottom of many of these other killings and nothing's ever happened.
No, that's right. I mean, I think it is that the tragedy of Russia today is one that the country has become so bitterly divided. And so, I mean, when I was there last in December and my friends who run a really impressive little pro-civil society NGO had just been declared foreign spies, this is a really unpleasant situation.
Mary, I watched something interesting about Boris Nemtsov the other day, which was a report by the BBC's Angus Roxburgh of him going with Boris Nemtsov to Siberia in 1997 and introducing us to this new wave of Russian politician, yes. Someone who's being talked about as a future president. I mean, I think he was just 37 at the time when he was appointed by Boris Yeltsin. What initially went wrong for him after he was so fated in those early days?
Well, in some ways, what went wrong for Boris Nemtsov was the collapse of the Soviet Union, because he was actually, he had an enormous amount of power and influence as a leader of the opposition in the late 80s and just before the Soviet Union collapsed. And he was, at that time, he was regional governor of Nizhny Novgorod. And he gave the city back its original name. It had been Gorky. It had been a closed city. It was reopened. He wanted to restore it as a centre of Russian and international trade, which is historically what it had always been, this gigantic city on the Volga. And to an extent, he achieved that by pioneering what were then completely, almost unthinkable reforms in introducing and allowing private enterprise at a time when that was it was extremely difficult to introduce even in Moscow to the extent that it was. And then after the collapse of the Soviet Union, then sort of chaos broke out in lots of ways, so that Nemtsov was on the one hand, he was sort of corralled into the Yeltsin government. So instead of being in opposition, which in a way was his natural habitat, he was in power and part of the power structures. On the other hand, the economy started falling to pieces. There was all this adventurism, the rise of the oligarchs. And that wasn't really Nemtsov's field.
He was almost too good to be true, actually. He was good looking, he was very articulate, spoke very good English. And, you know, when one met him, one sort of thought, oh my God, this really is something new.
But did he have enough popular support within Russia, Quentin? Or was he one of those, look, he's very good on TV, he's very good with the West, but actually, does he have grassroots support? Or did he have grassroots support?
Very difficult to say. Very difficult to say what is grassroots support in Russia. I mean, everybody's saying, oh, Vladimir Putin, Putin is so popular today. This is in a country where the entire television service, except for one tiny station, is actually controlled by the government. It's overwhelmed with pro-government propaganda. So I don't think one can tell really how popular Putin is.
No, but if you're thinking of just going back to Nemtsov for a minute, I think he's somebody who could have won popularity. He would have been able to use the media. He would have been able to make himself a national figure in other circumstances. And in a way, that's, you know, it's his misfortune in a way to have been so successful that the Soviet Union collapsed and then to be in a position where he wasn't really able to capitalise on it.
Yes, I remember, Mary, I mean, you and I both attended big rallies with Boris Yeltsin when he was sort of breaking through that popularity barrier. And these were huge rallies, of course, the like of which we've never seen since. And it was extraordinary, this rather gravelly voice. You know, there's one thing about Boris Nemtsov, tragic murder and end, though, that I find rather striking. All the people queued up to see him in the Sakharov Center yesterday. Now, Andrei Sakharov, of course, was banished to Gorky, to actually Boris Nemtsov's hometown. It reminded me of the way in which, when I was a correspondent in South Africa in the apartheid years, if they banished a really dynamic figure into the backwoods, that backwoods town became radicalized. And I was in Moscow, I think Mary probably too, when Andrei Sakharov died.
Yes,
an extraordinary.
Absolutely moving moment. Yes.
And I wonder, this is not the same, they're not the same sort of people, but nonetheless, this could be quite a dramatic moment.
Mary Dzhevsky, where does the Russian opposition, and obviously, you know, trying to group it all together is a bit is wrong in the first place, but where does it go from here? Because Nemtsov's dead, Navalny is under house arrest, and, you know, who knows what's going to happen with his legal cases. Khodorkovsky, if we want to call him opposition, is out of the country. Garry Kasparov is out of the country. Who is there?
Well, I think that in a way, being out of the country and even being under house arrest are not quite the handicaps that they used to be. Because social media, I mean, Navalny gained so much of his support through the social media, through the internet, which simply wasn't possible before. So there are ways around the system that there used not to be. I think the bigger problem for the opposition is that it's so fragmented. It's so fragmented between different personalities, and it's fragmented between different different strands of where people think the biggest problems are, where they think, and it's more sort of oppositionist than constructivist of thinking sort of where Russia might go. The only person who's really doing that is Khodorkovsky.
And Quentin Peel, a question for you on the opposition. There is, amongst certain elements of it, a nasty strain of nationalism that some observers feel would actually could actually be a worse form of nationalism than what Putin is currently instigating. Do you share those concerns with regards to some members of the opposition?
Well, Alexei Navalny is quite nationalist. That's undoubtedly true. But I think the nastier form of nationalism at the moment seemed to be out on the streets supporting Mr. Putin. You know, leather-clad bikers and wielding chains and stuff. It looks pretty nasty. It is a tragic division of the country that Putin has allowed and indeed encouraged to happen.
I want to stay in Russia just for a moment. A museum commemorating the victims of Joseph Stalin's rule may be forced to close. The Perm 36 Museum, named after the prison camp where it is housed, the financing for that was cut off last year. And local officials have now taken over the site and removed any references to Stalinist terror. Mary Dzhevsky, is this a sign that some strata of the Russian society are reappraising Stalin's rule?
Well, I mean, in a way, this is a bit of an old chestnut. Every time I see that Stalin's rule is being sort of rehabilitated, that Stalin is voted the most popular Russian in history or whatever, I think I'm not sure that anything has actually changed on that score. Generally, if you have these opinion polls, the West seizes on wherever Stalin is and ignores the fact that, say, Nicholas II or Alexander II are the most popular figures in Russia today. So I think the Stalin thing can get a bit out of proportion. And I don't see the threat to this memorial museum camp as really reflecting any change in the in attitudes to Stalin. I think it's more attitudes to it's a question of funding and the law on NGOs, which makes it difficult for people to raise funds.
Oh, I think it goes a bit deeper than that, Mary. I think it goes right to the heart of Russia finding it very difficult to come to terms with its history. Now, I've lived the
I
last...
I don't disagree with that, but yeah. I think the Stalin thing can be got out of proportion.
Indeed, but that, it still worries me deeply, because you must, to expose what happened in the gulags, you must have these places out there. What we see in Germany today about what they've done with concentration camps and so on is the way to deal with history. A bit in your face, and Russia hasn't done that yet.
And hasn't there been, certainly in the last year or so, with the way that that Putin has talked about Ukraine and fascism and highlighting Russia's role within the Second World War in fighting Nazis and fighting fascism, has then therefore meant there's been a little bit of a celebration, has there not, of then, well, what Stalin's role within that was?
I'm really not sure whether how far Stalin is associated with that personally, because the Second World War is so seen in Russia as a sort of as patriotic fervor and a victory for Russia. In fact, it's almost the time when the Soviet Union merges with Russia for the first time, and it's being seen as a national Russian cause. If you were to look at that from the perspective of the 30s, that would be very questionable.
I'm interested. Do you feel it's not sort of the two aren't linked, the sort of the nationalism and the man, in the way that obviously, you know, in the UK, you know, Britain and Churchill are as one when we talk of the Second World War?
I don't actually see that, because I think that Russia even today thinks of itself as having Russian roots, and that Stalin, with Georgian origins and these, I think he's seen as a Soviet figure. And obviously it depends a bit what stratum of Russian society you're looking at today. But I would say the sense of Russianness as opposed to the sense of Sovietness and Stalin's legacy, I think those are different things, and I see it more in terms of the Russian context.
But there's a confusion really about what was empire and what was Russia. Mm-hmm. And again, another thought from the Yeltsin rise. Yeltsin was brilliant at exploiting a feeling that the Russians themselves had been ripped off by their own Soviet empire. And it was a very interesting, if you like, switch around that he exploited. Now, I think Putin is in a way trying to put that genie back in the bottle. And I think there's a real problem in Russia today about saying, look, the empire is over. I know the problem from Britain here. We have trouble saying this, and they do in Russia too.
Let's end just there for now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Our guests today, Mary Dajewski and Quentin Peel. In a moment, we'll be talking about Germany's view on Greek debt. We'll also be talking about Irish people who may live in Ireland soon. And we'll also be looking at a new portrait of the Queen. Stay tuned.
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our four daily news programmes or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's the Time Shift, where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes, covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. My guests today, Mary Dajewski and Quentin Peel. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has been in Brussels today, meeting the European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker. The topics for today's discussions are all too familiar: Ukraine, Greek debt. In a press conference, both Merkel and Juncker did their best to avoid speculating if Greece could count on another aid package from its Eurozone partners. Quentin Peel, you were saying before we went on air that you'd been discussing with your colleagues who'd been there what was going on, and they'd said it was the most boring press conference ever. It's and it has got to that stage now, hasn't it, when we discuss you know, what's going on with Germany and Europe and Greece, that everyone seems to be going round and round the houses.
Yeah, it's sort of Mogadon Merkel. She's quite good at it sometimes. This is the way she just calms things down, you know, don't get upset, don't get het up. I do wonder sometimes, with all these crises going on, if we hadn't had somebody so steady as Angela Merkel,
exactly.
I think things would be much worse. But nonetheless, she is, of course, exactly what her electors, her voters, really want. And, you know, this calmness, this steadiness. So, look, we don't want Greece to leave the Eurozone. We don't want to kick them out, anything. But we've got to get this right. We've got to work this out together. I don't think she wants to thrust a new programme onto the Greek government if they're adamant they can't survive without it. But having said that, I think they're going to need it.
Jean-Claude Juncker is nominally, you know, one of three, technically, so presidents we have of Europe. But he was supposed to be the new elected man because we had these European parliamentary elections and all of Europe was voting for either Juncker or Martin Schulz, even if most of us didn't even realise we were doing that. And yet, one can imagine Mojzeszewski in a meeting between Angela Merkel and Mr. Juncker, who's really in charge.
Well, yes, but I think it's also quite interesting the way that Juncker especially was sort of built up as almost a hate figure in the UK by the government, as somebody who represented sort of federalism with a capital F in the way that the Brits really don't like it. And he's actually turned out, so far as I can see so far, to be almost a very similar sort of character to Merkel, in that he's interested in doing deals. It's all about calmness. It's all about organising things in a sort of sensible, reasonable way. And he's turned out to be much more sort of conciliatory than he was cracked up to be before.
OK. The Irish Prime Minister, Enda Kenny, has appealed to emigrants around the world to come home. A new initiative aims at attracting highly skilled young emigrants to return to Ireland, many of whom left the country after its economic crash. Mr. Kenny predicts that more Irish citizens will return home next year than will leave. If he's right, that would be the first time in almost 10 years. Quentin Peel, Ireland has this great diaspora of maybe a million people outside Ireland with Irish passports. It's a great thing for soft power for Ireland, but the nation could really do with some of them creating jobs and coming home.
Yes, I mean, of course, just to link our conversations together a little bit, there is Ireland is being seen in Germany as the model for coming out of the whole Eurozone crisis, as opposed to Greece, which really hasn't done the reforms and needs to do a hell of a lot more. So you read the German press today about Ireland and it's glowing. But the trouble is for Ireland, it is growing and it's lost rather a lot of young people.
Well, everything can grow. If it's, you know, you can burn down a forest and eventually something will grow again. It's what's actually there altogether. And, you know, there's an argument, Quentin, isn't there, that, you know, Ireland might be looking better than it was 2 years ago, but austerity hasn't necessarily been a good thing for it.
It hit a very low place. And it's Dublin that's coming up now, not necessarily the rest of the country. But having said that, what they need are some of these young people back. I mean, of those young people who emigrated, two-thirds had university degrees. They had degrees in pharmaceuticals, in IT, all this sort of stuff. In the old days, of course, I mean, Ireland has always had emigration. And then suddenly when the Celtic Tiger came in the 90s, it became a net inflow. Well, even then I was being told, look, the great thing is that people will go and they will come back. And I think that's what we're waiting to see. I mean, I've got an Irish nephew who's gone to Australia. Trouble is, he's loving life in Australia. So I'm
weather's
not
a
sure
bit
he's
better there,
come.
Isn't it?
Yeah, quite.
Mojzeszewski, many other countries have seen huge improvements to economies when people who have emigrated return. Now, whether that's through very tragic cases like in Rwanda after the genocide, or whether that's been in countries like Poland after many came to countries like the UK when the borders opened just over 10 years ago, and then they've come home and created interesting industries and so on. What needs to come first for Ireland? Does the economy need to grow, or do the young people need to come back?
I think in the first instance, the economy needs to grow, but I'm not sure that it's going to be that easy to attract them back, because the thing about Irish emigres, that I mean, they're not just what tend to be well qualified, but they tend to settle very well in the countries where they move. And so the way that, say, Russians always feel nostalgic for the homeland wherever they go abroad, they always have this idea that they'll want to go back. With the Irish, I don't get that impression. I get the impression they enjoy the sort of cosmopolitan international atmosphere that maybe they miss at home. And it'll be very difficult, I think, to attract young, qualified Irish people back.
But doesn't your heart sink when you go somewhere rather exotic and you see, oh my God, another Irish pub, and it's the last place you want to go to?
But they're successful. They're successful. Quentin Peel, obviously you have your Irish nephew who you think is probably going to stay in Australia. Were you, if you had roots in Ireland, would you think that now's a good time to go back, or would you think I'm quite happy where I am?
It's a tough choice. I think there will be some going back, because I think Ireland is a very different place today to what it was 30 years ago. Ireland is somewhere that's actually quite dynamic, is very well educated. They've attracted a lot of foreign investment and so on. So it's a really quite exciting place to be. Maybe my wife's family might say, well, you don't live here. You'd think that coming from outside. But I love it. I go there with such joy.
Okay. Finally, here in the UK, the Royal Mint has updated its portrait of Queen Elizabeth for new coins, which are going into circulation later this year. Earlier profiles of the Queen may have made her ageing process seem almost unnoticeable. Until now, that is. In the new coins, there are now visible wrinkles. Who would have thought it? The Queen herself has apparently approved of the new design, and we have pictures of it here in front of us. Mary Dzhevsky, she's 88 years old. That's not a bad, looking portrait of someone who's 88 years old, is it?
No, I think it's spectacularly good going. I mean, I think we'd all probably be grateful to look at least half like that when we get to 88. So, I also think, just looking at it, because we've got it in front of us, it is really a very excellent engraving. I mean, it does seem, and when you saw the pictures of the artist who did it, whose name, regrettably, I can't remember,
it's
somebody who's definitely of a totally different generation from the Queen.
Jodie Clark is the engraver whose design was selected. It was in a competition organised by the Royal Mint Advisory Committee. This is the fifth coin, Quentin, with Queen Elizabeth on. 1953, 68, 85 and 98. I remember when I was a kid, whenever I saw coins that had a different picture of the Queen on, it was quite exciting. It's like, oh, this is one of the early ones when she was just on the throne. It's one of those strange things, isn't it, that when we had the debate in this country about should Britain join the Euro, one of the really striking things was people said, well, okay, but does this mean we don't have the Queen on the back of our coins? Even for people who aren't arch supporters of the monarchy, it's oddly quite important, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that it's one of the things that probably guarantees why we've still got a monarchy, that people sort of feel it's the pound in your pocket. Hey, and she's on it.
And Mary Dzhevsky, if in a few years' time there is Charles III on the back of that coin, do you think people will feel a little bit different about the monarchy or about the pound in their pocket when it's his face?
Well, probably these coins with the Queen on will become extreme collector's items. I'm just about old enough to remember the last of the Queen Victoria coins, and I remember when you spotted them in your change, if you, it got a Victoria head on it, and it, in her last years, so she was very much into age rather as the Queen is. But these were huge collector's items, and you developed little groups of them. So I think Queen Elizabeth may go the same way.
We'll see. Quentin, Prince Charles, well, no, not Prince Charles, a King Charles III coin. It'll take a bit of getting used to, but everyone will kind of cope, won't they?
I think so, yeah. I think that actually he'll probably be quite loved when he finally gets there.
I don't know. We'll see about that. We'll see about that.
We're exact contemporaries, so I approve.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Quentin Peel and Mary Dzhevsky. apologies. Thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House. The programme was produced by Marcus Hippie. It was researched by David Pleasant and Mike Hewin. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Tom Edwards will be here with you in just a moment. And in half an hour's time, it's The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. It's 1800 hours London time, 1300 hours in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.